This is an interview for the Avon Heathcote Estuary Hutai Trust Oral History Project. The interviewer is Michelle Bradley. I'm continuing on the 5th of June 2009, the interview with Les Batchelor at his home at South Shore. This is the third interview session. We've had a bit of lunch, and for the last part of the interview with Les, I would like to focus on his and Dorothy's experience of being residents in the South Shore community.
Mm-hmm.
When and why did you come to live out here at South Shore?
Two reasons. One was I wanted to retire, and the second point was that I wanted to retire near the ocean. And so we just looked around until we found a place that suited both of us.
And how did that come about? What, did you specifically look at South Shore?
Oh yes, but it was almost the last place we looked at. We looked along the hill suburbs, Sumner, Littleton, far and wide, New Brighton, North Brighton, and eventually shifted our sights further and further south. And one day I was just sort of reflecting on it. I said, why don't we go to have a look down in South Brighton and South Shore? So I've never been down here. And so I started looking down here, and I looked at a lot of houses, and eventually found this one, and it suited me. I was very happy, and I persuaded Dorothy to agree.
Now, you had been living in, I think you said, in Papanui.
Correct, yes.
Do you recall the address? I thought maybe it was Norman.
73 Hartley Avenue.
So was it really the house that you settled on, or the locality, or
both? Both, yeah.
And so you mentioned that it was at the time that you were retiring. I think we had it that it was 1992. So you were still sailing, or had you finished sailing?
I retired 1988, but I worked for a while. And by 1992 I'd had enough. Yeah. So yes, that's when we came down.
And how did the adjustment go, both of you?
No problem for me. Dorothy had some regrets. Distance was more of a problem with her because she was still working. And she was, by then she was working out at Lincoln, so that was a long commute. So I was very happy here, right from day one.
And how were you occupying yourself?
Writing, reading, walking, but a lot of reading and writing. Yeah.
And was that on a variety of things? The concern with the estuary had started at that stage? Your investigatory work with the estuary?
And writing. We wrote the defence of the estuary came later, sort of messy. I just found my way into it with bits and pieces, but I was still writing stuff from way back, and still doing some modelling. I was just computer modelling on density functions, and I carried on that for quite a while. Finished that while we were here.
And what happened to that?
All in a box.
What was the outcome? What was the point of satisfaction for you?
No, it was frustrating because we could never find the probability function to satisfy the question. I found it empirically, just by setting up numbers and hunting for it, but we could never solve the theory. Maybe there is no theory that satisfies it. But, however, drew that to a close, and life moved on.
Could you briefly explain to me what it was you were doing? In
yep.
very general terms, otherwise it might be a bit of a foggy recollection.
Well, rather than counting entities, whether it be pippies or deer droppings or anything, in plots, sample plots, instead of doing that, I was measuring the distance from the sample point to the nearest of those entities. And the mathematical theory of that was not well known. And that's what I was trying to crack.
Did you have a thought of what you would uncover?
Did I have a what?
Did you have a thought of what you would uncover?
Oh, yes. I was hoping to find the magic formula that explained the world. of that problem, that probability distribution. Never found it, but I empirically got there, but not theoretically.
Would you describe your outlook onto the estuary from your home?
Oh, it is a beautiful land and seascape and mountainscape, varying all the time. And it's just a magic crown and the jewel of Christchurch. The jewel in the crown of Christchurch, I should say.
So here on Rocking Horse Road, you're almost to the end of Rocking Horse Road?
We're about 400 metres short of the end, yeah.
And not terribly far from the mouth of the estuary?
No, not far at all.
So you've
about 20 minutes walk.
You've got a very expansive view of the extent of the estuary from your house.
Oh, yes.
Has your connection to being here changed, increased in the time since you and Dorothy shifted here?
Mellowed, I would say. I would be happy to move on, but I'm quite happy to stay. But I was passionate then, but it burned itself out to some degree. But I became very involved very quickly when we came down here, because at that stage there was a resource consent dispute about the height of the sand dunes. And I had met some of the people involved in the South Shore Residents Association, and they hooked me in as their star turn, because I had a bit of training in mathematics. And so, I presented their case, and it was instrumental, I think, in keeping the sand dunes of something like 8 or 9 metres higher, the height. That was a matter of some issue, and it'll happen again. There'll be another tsunami. We'll want some protection. But while there is no tsunami, then they're in the way of the developers.
So the South Shore Residents Association, you met up with some of the people and became...
I joined up.
Joined up and went on to take on the role of chair for a number of years. Quite a number of years.
Yes.
What other... firstly... Can you recall the span of the time that you took the role of chairman until very recently?
I took the chair about 1998, and I relinquished the chair about 2004. Yeah.
What other concerns or matters of import came up during those years for the people who live out here at South Shore that the Residents Association put effort into?
The sensitivity of the landscape and the biota, the biology. It was perfectly obvious that people living over on the other side of the city didn't give a toss about South Shore or about the estuary. And to me, more and more, the estuary became one of the defining jewels of Christchurch. So I became more and more determined to try to protect it. Megalomaniac, perhaps, but I think it's worthwhile.
What about land-based issues for the people who live out here? on the spit.
Land-based issues.
Well, we've talked a bit about quite a bit about the estuary.
Yep.
So have there been other local concerns?
Oh, yes. There's been many. Probably the outstanding one was a storm, a big storm in 1992, before I came here. There was salt water, the ocean water was running down Rocking Horse Road. That scared people. It made them much more sensitive to the needs of protection rather than just knocking it around and doing what they wished with it, you know. But even here, when you see on this shore, on the shoreline, there's just about a quarter of a mile down there, 200 metres up there, about another 300 metres. Of people intruding on the shore.
Building.
And there's some very prominent people. Sir Tiffany O'Regan is one of them. I don't think he even knows what he did because he bought that place after it had been done, you know. And so it was just a house that was there, so he bought it, and it's a nice place. But it's so easy to knock this vulnerable landscape around and then pay the price.
Do you think that there are some parameters that could be set up, or I guess there are some, but do you have some ideas of what would be in the best interest of looking after the land and the people who want to live here?
Tread lightly. we can put a very heavy footprint on it if we want. It's interesting that you go back 40 years from now, and they were much more abusive of the landscape down here, of the spit, for example. They had cycle racing track or motorbike racing tracks and that sort of thing. That would just not be permitted now. We're much more jealous about the land. I remember meeting an elderly gentleman from a rest home over in Wickerton, who was just walking down the reserve one day, and we happened to meet. And he said, "This is a disgusting place. It should be knocked flat and built on, and you know, houses built on it. I could make enough money to pay for the sewage pipeline if I was able to develop the spit into housing." Over my dead body. Right. And he was perfectly sincere, but so was I.
Do you think that man will be able to hold back the change that's proposed, you know, with the spit, with the change of...
It will always be there. We're getting short of land. You look now, even in the few years that I've been interested in the statistics of Christchurch, we've gone from about 294,000 to 340,000 people. Now, they're going to have to go somewhere. What do? We go put them up in the air, out on the farmlands. Marshlands is the candidate for that, of course. Or down here. Or other places. I wouldn't mind guaranteeing that there'll be pressure on here for another row of houses to go out here, ultimately.
In front of you?
Yeah. But it's reserved from the garden just there. So it would require a legal quarrel. And I would be there fighting every step of the way. Yeah.
So you think that the most likely eventuality is increased
building density. Oh yes.
Rather than susceptibility to rising sea levels and increased.
I'm not Canute. I can't push the sea back. If the sea levels are rising, as they are, about 0.5 millimetres per annum, isn't it? So it's a very, very slow rate. That's calculable. You know, we can estimate how much that is. Happily, it'll be another 100 years before it's threatening. And, what other changes are going to happen? Probably a tsunami, probably a gigantic earthquake. I think an earthquake is a more likely massive risk than the worries about a tsunami or inundation of the estuary.
I wanted to refer back to the first interview that I did with you, and you told me about Jack Holloway and his response to you talking about climate change.
Oh, yes.
And I felt, you know, that I'd been very limiting in letting you speak on about your point of view and his point of view. I guess the opportunity is to, is there anything further that you'd like to say that what you saw in the 1960s, are you seeing more signs of what you saw
it's happening.
is it playing out in a way that you had
absolutely.
Some anticipation of?
Absolutely.
Do you think that there would have been any significance gained by more people having an understanding at that time, or it's all...
Perceptions will change as more research is done. The views will change. I don't doubt that at all. But I'll put it this way. I said or argued with Jack Holloway that the climate was changing. I could see evidence of the change of the landform due to climate change. Jack opposed it. And I told you the other day of his valedictory trip down to the Olivine Range when he retired. That was 1973. He came back from that trip. Now, Jack was the world's worst bludger for cigarettes. And so I made sure I had plenty of fags in my pocket, and I went in to say hello, welcome back. And he said, come on in and have a yarn. So we broached the cigarettes first, and he said, you wouldn't believe the change that I saw in the Olivines, that what were ice plateaus and dense subalpine forest is now open grassland and scree. And he said, you know, the climate is changing. And I said, well, Jack, do you remember what I bloody well told you when you argued with me?
Because you told me he'd been grub-staked there in the 1930s.
Oh, yes, in the 1930s. 1935 to 1938. He was grub-staked by Lands and Survey, just given a bag of flour, in effect. No salary, but just grub-staked, to go and have a look around the Olivines and write a survey report on it, because that was before the days of aerial photography, you know, and the Olivines were a very hostile place. So that's where Jack started off, yeah.
And that's near the Wakatipu?
Lake Wakatipu, yeah. Or actually, be a little more precise, Lake Wanaka.
Now, we're shifting topics a bit, but it's again focusing on your living in this locality. I'm wondering how much you and Dorothy make use of the services out in Brighton. Well, there's not so much amenities out here at South Shore, but in Brighton...
There are none here. No, we do most of our shopping from in New Brighton. Occasionally Dorothy wants a particular item and she'll go further afield. But I'm probably a Presbyterian at heart. I believe that you owe your loyalty to your community, and therefore I shop locally.
And do you make use of the car or buses or walk to go to Brighton in the city?
I have to say we normally go by car. But I sometimes go by bus, yeah.
I wondered, it might just take a moment of reflection, if you were to think about coming here in 1992 and coming out and crossing where Bromley is into Bridge Street and down Estuary Road and down here to South Shore, the change that has occurred, or maybe in the way that it was different when you first came through those areas, in a general kind of way, if there's anything notable that has changed in what you see as you travel.
I would have just about said business as usual. It's been a very stable landscape. there was disgust with the estuary. You know, the engineers were fed up with it. Blasted out of existence. You know,
sewage
treatment engineers.
Really,
it was a damn nuisance. Bar for the estuary, they didn't have a disposal problem at all. But because it was become, again, this stupid word, iconic estuary, people wanted to jealously preserve it and protect it. And that was a nuisance. That was quite a nuisance. Now, they've all come to terms with that now with the pipeline proposal. That's solved quite a metropolitan argument.
Now, I know that you both walk, and I know that you both have this very pleasant outlook into the estuary. Are there other things that you like to do in the way of recreation around the estuary?
Walk.
Principally walking.
Yeah. I used to be a squash player, quite a good one, but I had some major coronary episodes, and that persuaded me that I should stop. I've had 7 coronary bypasses, 4 stents. So coronary weakness is my problem. So, yeah, I just recreate within that and recognise that I'm now 75, you know.
What have you had to have long periods of convalescence?
Oh, the longest was over the quadruple bypass. That knocked me off my feet for a while. but I was back walking within a couple of months. Yeah.
And when did you stop playing squash?
After that major bypass, or before the major bypass. Yeah.
And how long ago was that?
It was just after we came down here. 1992 odd, yeah.
Now, you were also listed in the contributors to the Sand Dunes to Suburb South Shore History Group.
Oh, yes.
How did you get involved with that project?
Oh, well, that really was the initiative of Don Rowlands, who put it together. And he invited us to come down to his house, and he and Olive put on a cup of coffee. And we talked about getting a book going. And Don was the live wire. And I followed along and wrote my bit. Yeah.
I imagine it was very satisfying.
Oh, yes.
Was it?
Oh, yes.
And
well, it so often happens when you tackle a topic like that that's outside the boundaries of what anybody else has ever tackled, you start realising what's been going on. And this is when I started putting the thing together back to prehistory Māori, harvesting moa up in the headwaters of the Waimak and destroying the bush on the way and the fires from that destruction affecting where I live right now. So I have this sort of connected mind that tries to figure out what is affecting what and how does it show. And I'm quite sure the Māori built South Shore.
And what response have you had to that thesis?
Nobody's even understood it. I don't think people understand what I'm getting at. maybe that's just me being megalomaniac, but I think that's true.
Does that bother you that people
don't
understand?
Not at all, not at all. Make me feel very superior.
All right, here's a question that I wondered if you'd like to tackle and follows a little bit on from what you've just said, really. Of all the things that have been done to the estuary by man, what stands out to you as being the most ill-founded? Maybe you've already answered that.
The most?
Ill-founded.
Oh, discharging effluent into it.
Now, once the quality of the water in the estuary is improved, which is what's anticipated by the pipeline, is there any other major or minor aspects of the estuary's care that you would want to see attention given to?
No.
Of the various projects and activities and investigations that you've been involved with around the estuary, is there anything that stands out in your mind as being particularly memorable, or people, events, outcomes?
I guess the resource management hearings over the effluent discharge. Effluent discharge had been the bête noire of the estuary, and now that's being resolved. So, I think we are obliged by events just to sit back on our backsides and see what happens, and take a new view with a new circumstance.
But you certainly felt a sense of satisfaction.
Oh, indeed. Indeed.
Collectively, individually?
Both. I'm nothing if not arrogant.
But the group of people that you worked with closely?
Oh, it really made my day.
And again, what do you think was the pivotal moment? Was there a pivotal moment, or was it more like the...
No, there was a shattering moment was when Dennis O'Rourke said we had decided to build a pipeline. That was quite a change.
Can you describe the scene a bit to
me? Oh, yes. We were in one of the sub rooms of the City Council, being hectored, I thought, by Dennis.
Who's gathered there?
Oh, the general public. There was quite a lot of people there. And
it was a council?
There was very few councillors.
But it was a council meeting?
It was a public meeting by council or of council.
Just setting the scene, Les.
Yep, understood. And Dennis, he was the main speaker, and told us what had impacted on the city council, the arguments of the Estuary Association, etc., etc., etc. And just right out of the blue, and we have decided to go by pipeline to the ocean. That was just stunning. So O'Connor and I went down to the Ferrymead Tavern, bought a bottle of high-powered whiskey, retired up to his home and got mildly drunk.
I'll have to listen to what that descriptive word was before drunk. I don't know whether it was mildly or
wildly. Mildly, I think. Mildly. Oh, I had to drive home.
I wonder if you've had any direct experience of where you've been shocked or appalled by what you've seen or heard or action. You know, maybe an experience around the estuary, or maybe an experience in some kind of process where you've just really had the opposite experience of where it's unbelievable, really, what's been done or action or...
I think two angles. One is the way a number of people go along with garden forks digging up the tuatua and pepi along the foreshore. Now I'm critical of that because it makes a mess, and it's usually people who are fairly wealthy. You know, they're not poor people. The others that really concern me a lot are the Maori people and Asian immigrants who are coming in and see this tremendous resource, which, you know, if we were to compare our living environment with Hong Kong and the lack of opportunity to fossick for a shellfish in the inshore waters of Hong Kong, this must be heaven. And they treat it as such. But when a family goes out and everybody comes back with two buckets full of shellfish, when the legal take is 50, 60, I'm sorry, it's a bit obscene. And we have no right to reprimand them or anything like that. And the other interesting one is when you do speak to some of those people, they say, well, so what? Shut up and go away. We're not interested. So there is an attitude, an exploitive attitude, which is a pity. But it'll change. Attitudes will change.
We've talked a bit about your pleasure of living near the estuary and some of the things. The pleasure of living near the estuary.
Oh, yes, yes.
I wondered if for either you or for Dorothy, but I guess it's easiest for you to answer for yourself, whether there's a particular aspect of the day or the locality of the estuary that for you is particularly special.
Sunrise and sunset. Magic.
And on either side, or particularly on this side?
The whole day. If you get a clear day, like yesterday I went for a walk around the spit, and I got about halfway down and I just looked back. It's just such a pure, lucent blue sky, calm, beautiful. Really beautiful. So, yeah, I love it.
And, of course, you see the sun setting.
Setting here, yeah.
So the sunrise, your appreciation of that takes a bit more effort, or you just have to wait a bit longer?
Oh, have I not shown you the photograph?
I'd like to see the photograph again, but not, we're just about finished.
All right.
And if you go now, I'll have to stop the tape recorder.
Oh, it doesn't matter.
I would like to see, describe that photograph to me.
Sorry?
Describe
that.
And who took it?
Okay, that particular photograph was taken off our balcony at sunrise one morning. The sun was just coming up and illuminating the high-rise buildings over the city. And it's just a magic view. The press is often looking for photographs, outstanding photographs. Well, there's no press reporter ever comes down here. But it's a beautiful scene. Yeah, and I love it. I'd love to capture it on film. Yeah.
And are you a hobbyist photographer? Who's the photographer?
Oh, no, not a passionate photographer, no, just an opportunist.
Yeah. You can still get a good result.
Eh?
I said you can, with the material...
With some good results, pretty uneven. Yeah.
That is really the list of questions that I had to ask you, Les. I know that I've been firing them at you. The final thing, I guess, is do you think there's anyone else that you haven't mentioned during the course of the interview, an individual or organisation that you would like to make mention of, or anything else that comes to mind that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, there's one. I have mentioned him, but I don't think we've taken it up with Peter Neal, in terms of his experiences with wildlife and ornithology and shellfish. He would be well worth half an hour of your time.
Well, it's been a absolute pleasure and a privilege to meet you and spend the time with you. And I thank you and Dorothy very much.
You've been very welcome, Michelle.